Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. Lots of good information up today, especially on the headline-making event about the swine flu. And Global Research separates the fact from the fiction. Take a look. New material up today. Today, I'm delighted to have back one of the program's regulars, James Petras. Jim is Binghamton University of New York's Professor Emeritus of Sociology. He's had a very long and distinguished academic career. All he's been involved in so very much, along with being a prolific author. I don't have enough fingers and toes two times over, I don't think three times over, to account for all the books he's written and hundreds of articles. And when he writes one, I read it absolutely. It's as soon as it pops up, I jump to read it as quickly as I can. Jim, welcome back to the program. It's great having you back.
Good morning, Steve. It's a pleasure to be on your program again, where we can have a really good exchange of ideas.
Can you imagine if we could do this on primetime TV?
Well, it's probably a goal for the future, but in the meantime, Republic is as good an outlet as any.
Oh, indeed it is, and I believe we have a growing audience, Jim, and people are really craving this kind of information that you just can't get. Once in a while, I take a look. Oh, it's so painful to do, Jim, but once in a while, I take a look at what comes over the dominant media. I did it yesterday on the Lou Dobbs program. I once wrote an article about him a couple of years ago. I called him CNN's vice president of racism.
Well, you're pretty much on target on that.
Oh, indeed. I think that and a whole lot more. Well, it's so painful to watch and listen that I really need to just see where they're going and then mute it out, because I just can't stand the stuff that they put out. And, oh, my God, from beginning to end, such utter rubbish, trash, hate talk. What can I say about it? But never on a program like this. Jim, so much going on. I think the big thing that's happening since you and I were on last is this scare stuff about swine flu that is an absolute scam. Your thoughts about it?
Well, it's very clear that we have flu every year, and the deaths from the normal flu are about 35,000, with several million people affected here in the United States. And this supposedly pandemia is a totally false. It's nothing worse than a cold. If you look at the mortality figures of one child who had health problems prior to contracting this flu, that's one death. And more people die from overdoses of legal medicine in 1 hour than so far have been affected by this so-called epidemic. So the question is, why is this scare being mounted? Why is the World Health Organization involved? Why are these officials contracting the big pharmaceutical and vaccine-making companies with potential multi-billion dollar contracts at this time?
Oh, indeed, Jim, and with real serious things going on, not the least of which we've got foreign wars that continue, torture, occupation, the global economic crisis that absolutely is not getting better. So one way is change the subject. We need to take a quick break, Jim. Let's do that.
Okay.
And come back and continue on this. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Jim Petras. Oh, talking about swine flu, but we'll get into lots of other stuff too. Jim, they always use the same tactics. It bothers me no end that people don't know, number one, when they're being scammed. Number two, when the big stuff is being shoved aside by changing the subject. And number three, by always hauling out the old faithful technique. It works every single time. Scare the public and they'll swallow it. Hook, line, and sinker. So we had the war on terrorism. Now we got the swine flu scare. They'll haul out whatever else they want. And people drink this Kool-Aid and they believe it. One other comment and then you pick it up. Oh, I've quoted I.F. Stone a number of times. I think I mentioned it yesterday on the program. The great quote that he used to tell young journalism students that all governments are run by liars and nothing they say should be believed, or just shortened, all governments lie. But people believe this stuff.
Well, I think it's a mistake to say all governments and all politicians. It depoliticizes people. I think we have to point out the corporate governments that are tied to the war machine, governments tied to Israeli lobbies, deceive the public. But I think if we say that all politicians and all governments, we're saying, in effect, don't bother to vote, don't bother to engage in politics because you'll get swindled. So I think we should become more qualified in saying that particular parties, Republicans and Democrats, Obama or McCain, these are the governments that are built with corporate funds in their election. They appoint corporate officials from Goldman Sachs and others to run the economy. And that's why they tell us they're going to bail out American homeowners. Instead, they're bailing out the banks. So I would question Stone in his overgeneralizations.
Jim, I think he meant what I really mean, too. There obviously are exceptions around, and including in our country. You got to look hard to find them, but they absolutely are there. We've had terrific people. They just don't get in positions of power, and if they get there, the real powers manage to remove them. And in the world today, my goodness, we've got Chavez in Venezuela. And we've got the newest blogger on the internet. Well, one of the newest bloggers on the internet, Jim, Fidel Castro. A blogger. Imagine that.
There are dissident voices. There are countries where strong popular movements have succeeded in electing progressive candidates who are consequential between what they promise and what they do. And I think the social tensions around the world are rising as unemployment grows. And I think these recent months, we've seen large-scale May Day protests in other countries. And in that sense, I think the U.S. is an exception in the sense that we don't have a labor movement that even recognizes May Day as an international day to honor workers and put forth demands. And I think this is one of the crucial differences that the United States has with Europe, Asia, Latin America. We don't have a trade union movement that reflects the conditions of American workers. We have trade union officials drawing $300,000 to $500,000 a year who look more like corporate executives than they do representatives of the working class. Just look at the way they've stripped benefits from the auto workers in order to make them attractive to buyout firms. And look at the way Obama has intervened with his auto council, in which they are imposing conditions that even the corporations were hesitant to implement in terms of two-tier hiring system, cuts in pensions, a union is taking over its own pension fund, etc. So I think there's a crucial difference here where we need a new labor movement, a real labor movement in the United States that begins to be less in the pocket of Democratic politicians and more reflecting the interests of a great mass of workers. It's not a surprise that on May Day, the major bulk of marching workers were immigrant workers in Los Angeles and New York and elsewhere who are not under the thumb of the AFL-CIO, Andy Stern, or the other labor lieutenants of the capitalist class.
Oh, indeed, Jim, and you hit it on the head. We find our labor movement really eroding so badly, and the villains include the so-called labor leaders that literally sold out because, as you say, I mean, they don't make $10 million in bonuses, but my God, they get huge salaries and lucrative benefits, and it's to their advantage to play ball with corporate management and sell out the rank and file in doing it. I see what's going on, Jim, with the big three auto companies. And, of course, anything done to them reverberates right through the supply chain and the dealerships and really across industrial America. I think service America is already decimated. My God, few benefits, low wages. I guess you can keep cutting them down to less and less. But industrial America used to be so strong decades back. And they've seen all of their benefits just slowly eroding over the years. And I think whatever finally emerges from the final settlement with the auto companies, GM and Chrysler leading the way, then Ford will just mimic whatever those two do. And it'll be a model to take across industrial America and do the same thing to workers in the chemical industry, in the steel industry, and all the rest. And it's the reason that I say and I write that I think that there absolutely is a plan to turn America into Guatemala. And
yes,
I think we're heading that way.
And after the labor unions poured $100 million into Obama's campaign, they get nothing in the way of any proposed legislation, even the minimum legislation that facilitates union organizing is on the back burner. So we see that the strategy, the political strategy of these labor officials to count on campaign financing of Democratic Party politicians, people like Obama, it's a waste of money. They take the money during the campaign, make some general promises, and then they run. They run to their corporate colleagues. And I think this is really crucial. You can't keep thinking that labor has friends in the Democratic Party capable of implementing even legislation that allows them to organize the majority of U.S. auto workers who are now employed in Japanese plants throughout the South, Southeast, Southwest, and they're all non-union. It's unprecedented in the world, I think, in Germany and France and Italy, to have so large a percentage of non-unionized auto workers as you have in the United States. We have a new record, unfortunately a very negative one, as far as providing some kind of leverage for workers on the shop floor.
Oh, indeed, Jim. I think there's no question that we simply can't rely at all on the Democrats or Republicans for anything big. We really need a new political movement. And I know people say, well, you know, third parties never win. Well, my goodness, not in the 20th century, but go back to the 19th century. The Federalists, I guess, were the Republicans of their days, and the Republican Democrats split into the Whigs and the Jacksonian branch, and they became the Democrats. And today's Republicans began in totally different clothes back 1860, I believe. And 5 years later, they elected a president, and he happened to be Abraham Lincoln. Well, he wasn't a saint, but imagine an Abe Lincoln or an FDR in office now compared to what the Republicans or Democrats give us, night and day.
Yes, we're regressing rather than progressing. And I think I would like to mention that I'm looking today and yesterday at Obama's foreign policy performance thus far, and it's at best a continuation of the Bush administration. At worst, he's pushing us in directions that are not only destructive of American ideals, but actually worse. than the Bush administration. Let's take, for example, the Afghan policy. He's actually increasing the amount of funding for the Afghan war, increasing by 20-odd thousand the number of American troops. He's extending our war zone to include Pakistan, and the end result of this is, if you look at these two areas, Pakistan and Afghanistan, there is virtually no additional troops coming in from NATO. There is a destabilizing Pakistan and increasing the supporters for these countries by this indiscriminate bombing. So in both in terms of the objectives of stabilizing these areas and in terms of downgrading the war option American policy, Obama's worse. And if we look at another area, for example, Latin America, at the summit of the Americas meeting, the same thing. U.S. stood isolated as Obama reiterated the embargo over Cuba and kept Cuba on the list of terrorist countries against the opposition of 32 of the 33 countries in the Western Hemisphere.
Jim, we're going to take another break, but I'd like to come back to that topic when we come back.
Okay,
we'll be right
very
back.
Good.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Jim Petras. Jim, let me ask you one thing first that just popped into my mind, and then we can discuss the Summit of the Americas. Hugo Chavez gave Obama a copy of Eduardo Galeano's wonderful book, Open Veins of Latin America. Oh, I read that in several other of his books years ago. Have you any personal contact with him? He'd be a marvelous guest on this program.
Eduardo Galeano?
Yeah.
I have a phone number. I haven't met with him in recent years. I have a phone number. Maybe.
Does he have an email address?
I think I have a mailing address also, so we could talk about that at the end of the program.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I tried to see if I could spot an email address online, but there was nothing.
Yes.
There was nothing. And he certainly is prominent. He gets around and he gives talks and he takes interviews, so he'd be terrific on this program.
Yes, and I think he speaks pretty clear and fluent English. So,
oh, I've heard him interviewed, and indeed he does. Indeed he does.
I think he would be an effective speaker.
Oh, absolutely. Let's talk about the summit. My concern is, the leadership in all the countries down there know that U.S. policy has brought this havoc on their economies, maybe some less than others, but certainly Brazil has been impacted. They've all been impacted, just some more than others. You would think there would be an awful lot of distress, anger, whatever, over these policies that would just widen whatever small breach there is between the way they see the world and the way we do. Is there any hope to get that breach wider because of everything going on economically?
Yes, I think the Latin countries, even the moderate countries like Brazil and Chile, recognize that Obama came to the summit of the Americas conference with empty hands. Everyone recognized the U.S. was responsible through its mismanagement of the financial system for the crash and the recession and the drying up of credit. And so what they're doing in part is asking the U.S. to reverse its policies, increase the flow of reverse the outflow of capital and try to stabilize things. But they got absolutely nothing from Obama except some empty platitudes. So what's happened is they've deepened their relations with other countries. The U.S. is being bypassed. This week, as a matter of fact, the Prime Minister of Iran, with a delegation of 100 businessmen, manufacturers, agricultural importers, etc., are camping in Brasilia, meeting with their counterparts in Brazil in preparations for a massive increase in trade and investment between Brazil, the major country in Latin America, and the biggest economic power outside of the United States, to sign a plethora of economic arrangements. And Hillary is wetting her pants talking about this and mouthing cliches about terrorism when it's all about business. I mean, you don't bring manufacturers and agricultural importers to a country to talk about terrorism. They're there to do business. And as these amateurs, I call them amateurs, they're also reactionaries and failures, but they're amateurs. I mean, when you have an economic competitor dealing with a serious major country like Brazil, one of the 20 leading economies in the world, to start raising issues of terrorism is infantile. I mean, this is business competition. Can you compete? Can you offer markets? Can you offer contracts? Can you sign up cooperative agreements? And this is what's on the agenda. And they keep reiterating these vacuous cliches while the U.S. is being pushed out of one of its most important markets in Latin America. And the same goes with the Andean countries, Peru, Bolivia, and Ecuador are signing agreements with China, with Asian countries, because they have no openings with the Obama administration. So it's become irrelevant. And this war posture that Obama is developing toward Iran, they're now talking, taking their cues from the Israeli lobby in the United States. They're taking their cues about harsher sanctions on Iran and threatening British Petroleum, Total, Lloyd's of London for promoting the export of gasoline to Iran. And that's exactly what the APEC lobby this past weekend in Washington was all about. And they, of course, signed up the usual suspects to begin pushing these new sanctions, severe sanctions policies to Iran.
Oh, indeed, Jim, the APEC conference. Isn't today the final day of the conference?
I'm not sure. It was running from last Friday and over the weekend. I'm not sure.
Maybe it's over.
They're probably doing their lobbying now, tweaking the nose of congressmen who are on their campaign finance list to push this Israeli agenda, which is actually could precipitate a war. If they get sanctions on gasoline imports, that's a serious blow to the Iranian economy. And I think it should be highlighted as a war-like measure. And here's the U.S. again following Israel's lead instead of looking after American business interests in the United States. Here we are in a depression,
cutting off
further market.
We have to break again, Jim. Let's go right back to this as soon as we come back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Jim Petras. Jim, I always like to comment on the way the U.S. likes to negotiate. We, on the one hand, we extend a hand to Iran, to Cuba. And on the other hand, we slam them on the back of the head because our idea of diplomacy is to demand, not really extend a legitimate hand in friendship. We just don't do that. Go ahead.
Well, I think this is a fake gesture. I think it's precise. There's a relationship between these conciliatory gestures and the hard line they're adopting. Here they say, on the one hand, they're interested in opening a dialogue with Cuba, and then they turn around and put Cuba on the list of terrorist countries in the world. This behavior suggests the same thing with Iran. They say they want to start a new page with Iran, And then they escalate the sanctions into the more serious areas that even the Bush administration wasn't thinking of. They talk about opening a discussion with Iran, and look, the appointments. Dennis Ross, who is supporting a military option, is the State Department's lead man on Iran, and they reappoint Stuart Levy, who's on a obsessional world crusade, pushing sanctions and blackmailing countries and corporations not to have any dealings with Iran. So with Dennis Ross and Stuart Levy, virulent anti-Iranians in leading positions, this rhetoric of opening up a new chapter is pure unadulterated horse manure. I think that ultimately you have to say that this is a smokescreen.
Oh, it is. And then throw another guy in, Richard Holbrooke, dealing with Pakistan, I guess Afghanistan, and he's another one. I mean, this rogues gallery of people that they roll out. And Obama is this friendly face that very sadly most people still feel very, very well toward. I mean, he has a high approval rating. We really are in a terrible dilemma always, whether it's overseas or whether it's domestic policy. Just name the issue, and we really have a mess on our hands. And yet he still has a high approval rating, and I'm just waiting. I don't believe it will hold, Jim. I think eventually.
Well, I think you're right, Steve, because these are failed policies. Let's look beyond what this camouflage is and what the results of these policies are. I mean, there's no cooperation from Iran on the Middle East. The Iranians could play a very important role in pacifying Afghanistan. They did at the beginning of 2002, so they're not getting any cooperation from Iran. They're prejudicing their position in South America by raising this security issues instead of economic aid. They're losing out to competitors. You look at Korea even. Here's a country that under Bush we were negotiating dismantling of their atomic facilities, and in comes Hillary Clinton and Obama threatening them with new sanctions because they shoot a missile over Japan, and they begin to go back to rebuilding their nuclear bomb facilities. So what's the result, the practical result of these hardline policies? They're all boomeranging. U.S. is losing influence. It's not stabilizing Afghanistan. It's multiplying the opposition in Pakistan. There are now whole territories in Pakistan that are run by the Taliban. The government there, which is very close to U.S., has lost control over strategic areas along the whole frontier. So it's not merely that the military policies are bad. They're unsuccessful in terms of the policy goals that the U.S. lays out for maintaining its influence and hegemony in these areas.
I don't see how that possibly can work in the end, Jim. And at the same time, we keep pouring just incredible sums of money, spending more money than the rest of the world combined. And we don't have a single enemy in the world except the ones that we deliberately make because of our policies. And these things will fail. You talk about it. You write about it. People like Chalmers Johnson do it all the time and just talk about how, every previous empire in the world that tried stuff like this ended up the same way. They went down. They failed.
Well, think of it in the context of a depression. Here we need to expand our markets. Here we need to look for new financing. Here we need to cut back on the deficit. And the policies are doing the opposite. We're increasing areas of military conflict rather than securing markets. We're increasing the deficit by increasing military spending at a time when resources should go into reviving our manufacturing and providing greater subsidies for the unemployed so that they can pay for their food bill and rent. So what we're seeing is a vision of American policy as an instrument for military expansion rather than of economic recovery. And this is a formula for disaster. You can't move in opposite directions. Non-productive spending versus economic depression.
We do have a depression, I believe, Jim. It's very possible, though.
Well, they say one out of every four people in the United States has a relative that's unemployed.
Oh, indeed. Well, the so-called unemployment numbers are so greatly understated. I like an economist I had on the program, John Williams, and he reverse engineers the data. The last number I saw before the new report comes out this Friday, and jacks his number even higher, he had unemployment at 19.8%. When all the under and unreported categories are included, including discouraged workers, involuntary part-timers who may work as little as 1 hour in a month, yet they're called employed, and this fictitious 8.5%, there's no question that we're way, way above. Even the Labor Department, Jim, has two categorizations. I think one they call U3 and the other they call U6. And I think U6 is the one that never makes the news. And by their U6 calculation, I think they figure unemployment something in the mid-teens, something like maybe around 15%. But you never hear that number mentioned. This includes some of these unincluded categories. But, my God, these are real human beings. Yet we'll come out with a number that will probably be at least 600,000 this Friday. The true number may be closer to 1 million, but the markets will cheer it because the famous expression, Jim, better than expected.
Yeah. Well, the figure that is most shocking, a historical figure, is the rate of unemployment among blacks, especially black youths in urban cities. And under an Afro-American president, he's done absolutely nothing. There is no program, inner city program, to cope with the 40 and 50% unemployment rates for young blacks under 25 years of age. And I think it tells us something about the importance of color in politics. If you have an Afro-American president who's basically got his head in Wall Street, he has absolutely no positive policies directed to the African-Americans in the great urban conglomerates of the United States. And what it means is class is more important than race when it comes to determining whether a president is progressive, whether it's a historical victory or not. I think it's a historical disgrace to have an African-American president who does nothing when you have catastrophic unemployment rates among black youth.
He was my senator. I live in Illinois. He was my senator, and I followed him a little bit in that capacity. And he basically sold out the constituency that elected him in the Senate. So it doesn't surprise me a bit that he's continued that as president. But you're right. I mean, these people got him his start in the state legislature, then the U.S. Senate, and now he's the president. And he literally chucked them overboard. And, of course, Latinos and poor people overall. And we really have a desperate situation in the country now where hunger alone and growing poverty is a major, major problem. So we talk about this nonsense swine flu that will affect a minute number of people, an inconsequential, shouldn't even be mentioned, but of course they're using it for other purposes. And we have this real pandemic of extreme poverty growing, hunger, all kinds of serious problems affecting many, many millions of people in this country alone, never mind the rest of the world, and nobody even talks about it. It doesn't exist because nobody talks about it.
Yes, and yet if you talk to people in the street, the first fear they have is of job insecurity, not getting a job, a son or daughter that graduating from school and can't find a job. These are the real worries and fears of the American people. I hardly find anybody that voluntarily raises the issue of swine flu. It's not part of their world. It's not part of their family. It's not something they experience in their community, but they do experience loss of jobs, layoffs, firings, downsizing, reducing the hours of work, cutting off health insurance. This is the great fear in our country. It's the media that have cooked up that there's a widespread concern about swine flu. I think if you just go out in the street or go to your gym or walk your dog and you talk to people in the street, there is a tremendous divergence between what the media says they should worry about and what people actually worry about in their everyday life.
But they need to point a finger at the administration too, Jim. It's still, I agree with you 100%. But at the same time, they still think that Obama, he's only been in office a few months, so it stands to reason that enough people haven't awakened yet. But they still look to him as, call him the great black hope or anything.
Well, it's grabbing at straws, and on the other hand, it's this tremendous, overwhelming propaganda campaign by the media. They present him in the most favorable light, you know. Some critics of the media talk about corporate media as being Republican or right-wing corporate, but if that may be the truth in some instances, but it makes no difference. We get a Democrat who was elected on a program of liberalism, and yet they go by what he's doing, not what his label is, and they've been overwhelmingly whitewashing Obama, CBS, CNN, ABC, etc. They have presented a picture of a successful president who is doing great things, and they maximize his exposure as a go-getting, innovative president, when what's striking is the continuities in his big policies on war, regional wars, Wall Street bailouts, and is ignoring the conditions of American workers.
Well, you've done your share of exposing what the guy really is, Jim, and you're
right. But like you say, there's still people that do this counting. On the one hand, he says this. On the other hand, he's doing that. On the one hand, he's talking about peace. On the other hand, he's carrying out. There's no consistent consequential analysis that says, look, these gestures are meaningless. These policies are real.
Oh, absolutely. Well, countries do talk peace when they're planning war, and Israel does it all the time. And they talk about even Avigdor Lieberman, this utter fascist who's the foreign minister, talks about pursuing peace. Well, get me out of the way of the idea of peace that he represents. But, of course, Israel doesn't pursue peace. A two-state solution means lock people down in a little scrubland completely isolated. And when the U.S. talks peace and all the good words, the rhetoric that comes out of Obama's mouth, the real policy behind it is an iron fist. And they're giving to the privileged and taking it from the rest of us. And this is the real guy. And I'm convinced in time, as the pain gets deeper, I mean, Obama's got still close to 4 years to run. As the pain gets deeper, I think by the time he finishes 4 years, he may turn out to be a one-term president, not because the Republicans routed him out, but because people finally realize, well, gee, he's no different than the others. So let's get somebody else.
Yes, I think the whole fiasco of the Democrats, unfortunately, may provide an opportunity for the hard right to come back, and that would be a double tragedy. The dismal failures of the Democrats setting up conditions for a revival of Newt Gingrich and these ultra-right wingers. And I think this is the danger of American liberalism, is tying their hopes to a political cadaver. Leaving open dissenters, critics, disillusioned people to embrace a kind of neo-fascist revival in the United States. And that's why I think it's important not only to unmask the failures of this administration, but to try to construct an alternative to it, plus the extreme right that is will capitalize eventually on this disillusionment, particularly if the recession deepens.
Oh, absolutely. I think the way they would do it is to bring out a good old boy face. Newt Gingrich, to me, is a stretch. But, you know, they did it in 2000 with George Bush, a good old boy. Nobody knew anything about him. Just a friendly guy. And you remember the way he was described, as a guy you'd like to sit down and have a beer with. Well, you know, I mean, the Iron Fist is right behind him, but you don't see the Iron Fist until it's too late.
Yeah.
So I think probably what they'll do, I have no idea who the person would be, but they'd pick another good old boy, friendly sort of face. They might even pick a woman, Jim. Who knows? Now, wouldn't that be something if they can come up with a friendly, good old girl candidate? And who knows? But something sinister they'll plan. The Iron Fist will be behind it, and we won't see it until they get reelected. Oh, we need to take another break, and the time does go by fast, Jim. Let's do that, and then you finish up with some final thoughts.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to NewsHour. I'm on with Jim Petras. Jim, we both get a lot of emails. I just saw one that popped into my inbox with a terrific quote from a retired Senator Fritz Holling, South Carolina. Oh, listen to this. I don't know why they don't say these things when they have a public stage and more people would hear them. But he said, "We can't jumpstart the economy because there is no engine under the hood. Our auto industry is dead, and many of our manufacturers have gone overseas. Silicon Valley is dependent on computer engineers trained in India. Our youth are so poorly educated that America can no longer compete with the rest of the world. The Army no longer requires a high school diploma and will even take recruits with criminal records." Maybe I should invite him on the program, Jim.
I think so. I think he's touched on a very important issue. And that is, what economy are we going to revitalize? Are we going to simply put money into consumers' hands so they can spend it, and then what? Are we going to revive banks? What are the banks, industrial, manufacturing, productive sector are they going to lend to? Are they going to turn back and lend again to real estate speculators and developers who are not creating a sustainable economy? I think that's a crucial issue. I think basically what we have to think of politically in this context is that groups in their particular area of pain should organize. The unemployed workers' councils that I experienced in Europe and in Latin America, particularly in Argentina, were notably effective in getting vast programs of money injected into employment generating jobs. People that are living off of food stamps can organize. I was in Mexico in the 90s, where they organized against foreclosures on farm properties and housing. I think people that are directly affected, they can't take this, you know, me and the foreclosure agent, me and the employer that fires me, me and the food staff agency. I think that people, and we're talking about millions of people now, we're talking about 12 or 13 million unemployed. We're talking about 15 million people facing foreclosures. The question is not to personalize or individualize these grievances. It's to socialize them and put together at least single-issue organizations that can begin to bring people together into some kind of effective pressure, a visible pressure. I mean, in unemployed workers in Argentina, when it reached 25%, in some neighborhoods it reached 50%, they were blocking major highways that affected the movements of commodities into markets, into banks. And they were very effective because the system couldn't work. Their system thought they could work without the unemployed, but the unemployed made it impossible for them to carry on business as usual. So unemployed councils, mortgage holders, foreclosure councils, food stamp councils, all these organizations could become the rivulets that form the river for a new political alternative.
Oh, indeed, Jim. I wish we could keep this thing going, but that music means they're going to break away to the next program. The next host does want to come on here very momentarily.
Well, you have a wonderful list of speakers this week, Steve, and I think this is just part of this serial activity, wonderful activity that you're
providing.
Oh,
thank you, Jim. I'll send you an email so we can get you back in this program quick. Listeners love you.
Okay, Steve.
Thank you, Jim.
Un abrazo, as they say in Spanish.
Indeed. And join us again tomorrow. Another terrific program tomorrow. And the next day. And next week. Please join us.